Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
Good morning, Buddha. What is your name?
Good morning. Baruch.
Baruch. Great, welcome. And Veronica, is that right?
Yeah,
great. Thanks for coming. We're still working things out at the Zen Center. You know, how does this... We have a lot of hacks. And that's kind of what I'm going to talk about today is that we're working things out. Sometimes unsuccessfully. In this tradition, this Zen tradition, as it moves, as it meets, in particular, this culture that it's landed in so recently. We're in the first, second generation, really, of Zen in the West. And we're trying to figure out how it's all going to work. You know? I think Zen offers something really precious to the world, and certainly to the West. I think its core offering, you know, the word Zen means meditation. Its core offering is what we just did, is this silent meditation in which we learn to give ourselves up for a moment, all of our concerns and our worries, that we learn to leave those at the door. And the way it was put to me, manifest a different kind of self that isn't my everyday self, but is my quiet self. And to really learn over time to not only express that, but to identify with it. That also is me. And the way the Zen tradition puts it, that is my true nature. That is my truest, deepest nature. Takes time, first of all, just to get a little glimpse of it, to wind down enough that we can feel that. But I think that this is something that this tradition can offer to the West, to the world. It's not even ours, you know. Like Zen says, the finger pointing at the moon. That experience of quiet is the moon. And we're just a finger pointing at the moon. When you find the moon, you don't need the finger anymore. That's built into our tradition, that it's not, we don't own the moon. And yet, Zen has been for, you know, 1,000+ years pointing at the moon, taking a look at the contours of the moon, understanding how to work under the moonlight in a way that helps others. So we've got this long tradition. That's why I think somebody like Thomas Merton, who had his own damn tradition of contemplative prayer and found so much in the Zen tradition that could help him. So I think that is the pearl, really, that that Zen can most offer the world. But that pearl is part of a context, is in context. And that's kind of what I want to talk about today, is both the core of Zen practice and also the context the larger container. And I think it's possible for anybody, and it's definitely possible for us Westerners, I guess. Maybe, do I want to blame it on the West? Maybe. To take just the pearl, to want just the pearl, and not want the surrounding context, or not want to kind of work with the surrounding context so much. You know, there have been studies of that. I had read this fascinating study years ago that I can't find now, of course, but that had first graders, I think, look at pictures, like of an ocean scene, underwater ocean scene with fish and things, and the American kids tended to remember the details of the biggest fish, and the Eastern kids tended to notice the whole picture, like what was under the water, the rest of it. And we have this tendency, it's assumed, to focus more intently on something rather than to look at the whole context and understand the relationships and so forth. And I think that the context of this practice really does matter. It helps us get to that core. And to find that no self aspect that we all have. And I also think that it helps us understand how to use it, how to help it manifest in our lives. And which I think helps the long-term practice. This practice really is it's a long-term practice, I believe, and I think the context helps with that. You know, reading on Wednesday nights, those of you who come on Wednesday nights, the thing that we're reading right now is called Novice to Master. It's a 20th century Zen teacher who talks about his experiences in the monastery. And so many of those experiences are, I mean, he talks a little bit about no self and meditation, but so many of the experiences that had a real deep and lasting influence on him were from the context, you know, were this great, you know, his teacher. I'm not going to go into all the stories, but his teacher tells him to sweep up this stuff, and he says, okay, what should I do with the trash? And then the teacher teaches him one thing at a time, what to do with all that stuff, and then his final word is, in people and in things there is no trash. Now, that is part of the context of our practice. That's something that he really had to think about and consider, and it had a deep impact on him. But that, in my view, is part of the context. And there's many other examples of that. You know, how to hit the emphasis on death, for instance, in that book, how to approach our own death, many other things. And in this practice, too, you know, we have this, we meditate, but as the folks who just came, we don't run right into it. We make you go through all this other stuff before you get to that good stuff. And that other stuff, I kind of believe in. It's not fixed in my mind, just exactly what we do, but for instance, the chanting kind of sets a container in a certain way, kind of orients us in a certain way. The four great vows that we chant just before, that we say just before, that we chant and then say, as if, for instance, orients our practice toward helping others, toward working with our own karma in the second one, and things like that. And the chanting itself just wakes up our body, just is a practice of blah, 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 which helps us remember our body and helps us remember to breathe. So all of these things are part of the context, and that's why we study the history and the philosophy and the poetry of Zen, to give us a context for this pearl. Buddhism, you know, started in India, and there it grew and it changed in relationship to Indian thought. So, for instance, to the concept of reincarnation, or the six realms, which sometimes I mention, those predated Buddhism. It's just Buddhism worked with those because that's what was in the atmosphere. And so the Zen school, for instance, kind of way de-emphasizes any idea of reincarnation now, but other schools don't. And so when Buddhism came to China, the same thing happened, and Zen was born in China, so really it's a Chinese creation, and has been, Buddhism and Zen were deeply affected by the dominant philosophies of the day there, Confucianism and Taoism in particular. And you can see some of the things that we do right now. These robes, you know, these are Confucian scholar robes. The longer the higher class you are, because you can't work. You've got, you know, just not working in the fields with these things, I'll tell you. And the rise of monasteries and the way the practice is structured, the emphasis on lineage, all of these things come from Confucian ideals. And as well as the poetic tradition in Zen, which didn't really exist in India so much, our kind of closeness to nature. You don't see much of that in the old Indian texts, but we got that from Taoism. Direct link. I think it's really worth paying attention to this context, to understanding it. And in particular, those who are more experienced in the Zen school, to become leaders, you know, we're most charged, everybody's working with it, but we're most charged with figuring out how Zen's going to work in this new culture. Figuring out what we're going to keep and what we're going to change. And to understand where it comes from, to understand that context is important. So it's not just important to our practice, it's also important to this changing situation we find ourselves in. I think, by the way, it's possible to get lost in the details, lost in the context, and in the mythologies and the stories, in the forms, and lose the heart. Forget about that, really, that pearl, which is self-examination and really deeply losing yourself, deeply understanding that true nature, finding it. I think it's quite possible to get caught up in the context, become a, you know, really good at Zen. Have a kind of smell of Zen. Yeah. And there's an old Zen put down, you know, you stink of Zen. Mm-hmm. That's what happens when you get too caught up in the context. But it's also possible to get too attached to only the middle part and disregard the context, I think. That's also possible. Where like the pearl is the only thing, and I think it's possible that as Buddhism has moved to the West, you know, pluck the idea that you can just pluck out the pearl, and you know, I mean, I want to be subtle about this point because I'm happy that my father gets a, you know, a pamphlet about what to do after surgery, and one of the three things it says to do is meditation. I'm really happy about that. But at the same time, I think meditation, that pearl in a way, can be taken out and used and misused by the culture that it finds itself in. And I think that is also a kind of something to look out for. used for, you know, companies' own needs to make more productive workers, or only seen as a road to better health or self-improvement, and not seen as something that helps the whole society, that helps others, that is primarily for your family, for your coworkers, for others. So I think it's possible to overvalue that middle part, that experience of no self, and also figure, it's also possible to figure, and I've seen this too, that if you just reside in that perfect place, perfect acultural place, if you can just reside there, then everything else will be okay. It'll solve my life. It's possible to feel that or to think that in a kind of romantic way. And I think my own feeling is that we need context. We need context of morality and philosophy and community, very much so, in this Zen path. That's what I think. So you can feel me sort of balancing these two things. Or embracing maybe both of them. As this path has moved into this culture, this Western culture, I think it's possible to see, and I hear it said, you know, that our primary culture, the culture that's coming into, is dominated by Christianity or by Judeo-Christian values. I see things a little bit differently than that. I think that what I've been considering recently is that in the West, actually our dominant philosophy is humanism. And the humanism that has its roots in the Enlightenment of the 18th century. And I'm really interested in examining that humanism carefully myself, looking at it, and looking at places where we have resonance. This path, this Zen path, has resonance with that. I maybe would. I'm an American history major. I was interested in the roots of the American Revolution in particular. My parents are historians, American historians. My father's a colonial historian. So I have that kind of karma. So know that. I'm running into it, you know, over and over again in different ways recently, and it's become a real interest for me. I don't think I've told anybody that, but that's coming up for me kind of strongly these days. Steven Pinker has had a Harvard psychologist and thinker who wrote The History of Violence, has had a real influence on me recently. His new book is about the Enlightenment and Enlightenment humanism and its effect that it's had on our society. It's basically positive effect that it's had on our society. That Enlightenment, that humanism, it's often said, starts with a kind of skepticism to the laws that have been handed down to us. I'm just going to hit two or three of its major points. It began with Newton's Principia. Where does anything begin? But that's often when it's dated to start, late 1600s. And so the science and the scientific method and reason is a very important part of it. Something that you might not think would fit very well with Zen, but I think probably fits better than some people think. Reason and science as a way to understand the world rather than relying on superstition. There's a belief in the rights of the individual. You know, Voltaire was all about life, liberty, and property, actually. Jefferson changed it to the pursuit of happiness. Equality, a basic equality that we all have. And also empathy, that your experience is not that different from my experience, no matter what our class, no matter what our race, no matter what our gender. And that there is a possibility for us to cooperate with each other in a way that helps both of us. That was a deep belief in the Enlightenment, among the Enlightenment thinkers. And of course, there's no supreme deity also that handpicks rulers in particular, that you need the consent of the governed in order to rule. All right, I'm winding down now, I promise. But Buddhism and Zen are, I think, are compatible with humanism in some ways. So for instance, the Buddha was sometimes called the great physician. Was really kind of took a scientific approach, if you ask me, to his experience, and did not need a higher deity or authority, and was really a reaction against the Brahmin tradition. Zen itself is stripped of superstitious beliefs, or tries to do that. I don't think it always succeeds, but ideas like merit, for instance, the gods, or even the authority of the Buddha. You know, when you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. I think also there's this importance in the Zen tradition of the individual human heart and an individual initiative, that we can do this. We don't need... Zen is sometimes called the way of self-power. I mean, there's two ways in Japan, Jiriki and Tairiki. Zen is one of the self-power ways, and versus the other power ways that need somebody else's help or a deity's help. Rinzai, the founder of this school, was a big advocate for that sort of "you can do it." And one of the great Rinzai scholars in Japan talks about specifically Rinzai's humanism. And that's something that I'm going to read a lot about next year, if I can find stuff in translation. And I think also the notion of equality, that we all have something, that we all share something, no matter what our station. So I feel that that this and all the yeah so in summary, I feel that this experience of our own true nature is terribly important, and I'm unashamed to say we have to work for that. We have to work really hard for it, I think, and not assume that it's going to be just handed to us. We have to sweat tears to find it in this tradition. And at the same time, I think it's possible to over-romanticize this awakening to our true nature and to believe it will do everything for us. And when that happens, it's possible for us to put our awakened teachers on pedestals that doesn't really help us, that doesn't help us experience it for ourselves. This experience, this deep experience, is, I believe, acultural. It can't be touched by culture. It's not owned by Zen or anybody else. But the culture that we surround it with in this school is Zen Buddhism. And that culture is malleable. It's always changing. And I think it's a work in progress, to be sure. I think that this Western humanism that comes from the Enlightenment can contribute to the container, to this container, to this context, in ways that don't degrade Buddhism, but actually help it. Zen's new in this culture, and I think we have to decide which strands to pick up from the culture and which to take care with. But I think there's certain aspects of humanism that I think we can learn from and that may help us.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.